You're listening to 21st Century Permaculture Revolution Disguised as Gardening here on shoreditchradio.co.uk, talking about how people are changing their worlds with permaculture and mixing in some amazing retro funk along the way. And I'm here in the studio, and it's getting a bit chilly. The summer seems to have decided to wave goodbye almost on the dot of September the 1st. The leaves on the tree outside my house just started falling, and I started having to sort of kick them aside to walk away. So it's a lovely sort of autumn changing coming on, and and with the sort of this idea of change, I'm the sort of current definition of permaculture that I'm sort of wrestling with at the moment, and I'm enjoying the sort of the current discussions of trying to define sort of permaculture or permaculture design. Some people really love to make sure that word is on the end of it. And both for me have the quality of sort of this multidimensionalness, meaning that sort of at the heart they are very flexible and malleable and changeable and ready to evolve. And which reminds me of the central question for me around permaculture, which is the thing that I ask people back. So what would permaculture mean for you, rather than this holy idea of what permaculture is for everybody? What does it mean to each individual person personally? And I've got Joseph in the studio today. Say hello, Joseph.
Hi Stefan.
And what's your current, do you have a definition of permaculture? How do you describe it to others?
I don't really have a fixed definition, but I quite like Graham Burnett's succinct one, which is creating sustainable human habitats by following nature's patterns. That gets to the point and sums it up kind of quite nicely.
Yeah, Graham was on a little while ago, and he has a good turn of phrase. There's no doubt about that. With the the theme that we're sort of exploring today with Joseph, and it could be all manner of things with Joseph, I must say, is the idea of cooperatives. And cooperatives sort of include, there's loads of different types. It includes sort of non-profit community organisations and consumer cooperatives and workers' cooperatives and housing co-ops and credit unions. And I sort of looked it up on Wiki, and so because I was like, okay, well, what actually does it make up? And so it says, is a cooperative is an autonomous association of people who voluntarily, and I think it was even underlined the voluntary bit, cooperate for their mutual social, economic and or cultural benefit. And they're quite fashionable right now in the green movement, and which sometimes leads to commentators regard us all as sort of thinly disguised bunch of commie bastards. And how would you describe a cooperative when you're talking about co-ops, Joseph? What's your sort of...
There's the official definition, which is the beginning of which you were reading there from the ICA, the International Cooperative Alliance. The end of that sentence is through jointly owned and democratically controlled enterprises or something like that. Mm-hmm. So for me, the short version is a democratic business, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. I think that's quite understandable, and it sort of cuts out the sort of the faff around what it might be, because there's lots of definitions, and I think it's in a way it's quite similar to permaculture, isn't it? Because there's lots and lots of different types of co-ops out there.
There are lots of different types of co-ops, yes, although there aren't lots of different definitions of a co-op really in the same way there are with permaculture.
Yeah,
there is the sort of internationally agreed and recognised by the UN and everything definition of what a co-op is. Mm-hmm. Which you can find on ica.coop, which is like the overarching body of co-ops worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute. So, but before we do that, we're going to give it up or turn it loose.
Back to light the other.
So I'm here with Joseph David Coates, and I've known Joseph for a good few years now. A lot to do with the permaculture, the London Permaculture Network, the festivals, and Joseph has talked at quite a few events that I've put on. And how I describe Joseph to other people, and it does come up occasionally, Joseph, that I describe you, oddly, that might sound, is like, I always go, oh, you need to speak to Joseph about that. And so I feel like Joseph is sort of a repository of a lot of information, and particularly stuff that's online. And actually, you describe yourself on your own website as a cybrarian, which I quite liked.
It was actually an open source developer who gave me that title. But yeah, it's like a cyber librarian. I do seem to like downloading, collecting and organising and then uploading to our United Diversity Tools for Change library, various PDFs of import.
Yeah, there's a big repository of stuff, isn't there? Yeah. I remember asking you for a book once, and you said, oh, you just need to go to our library.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff there. Almost too much for some people, because not everyone is an info junkie like me. So some people, I think, get overwhelmed by the amount of information that's there.
Mm-hmm.
So we have got plans to sort of create online courses that create sort of like a learning journey through the best of the content, for example.
Yeah, there is a lot of stuff. And I mean, is the idea that it's a sort of a library of open source how-tos, how manuals and things like that on, I mean, give me an example of some of the sort of diverse range of information that you have on your...
So yeah, we've got various shelves or folders of files in the library, which broadly speaking, I guess, are things I consider about the state of the world or what to do about it. It's mostly the what to do about it bit, but for example, there's an energy folder which has a peak oil folder which has all of the key reports about peak oil and energy's ascent. There's a climate change folder which has all of the sort of key reports about climate change. But then there's loads of what to do about it type stuff. So there's a folder about community land trusts and money and economics, which has folders about community currencies and cooperatives.
Is it just when you're surfing around, you think, oh, that should go in there, or that should go in
there? Yeah, as I sort of find things, I think, oh, that looks like a good document. Like today, Ray Publica published an article about community-based renewable energy projects. So yeah, it's not uploaded yet, but it's on my local drive to be added to the relevant folders about community energy and cooperatives and what have you. But it's also often prompted by people emailing me and asking me questions. Because if someone emails asking about land value tax, for example, or multi-stakeholder cooperatives, or sociocracy, which is sort of a fairly nice organising model, that sort of triggers me to go and check what is in the library and update it.
So you're looking for gaps as well.
So I often then spend an hour or so going and finding all the latest, greatest stuff like that, so that when I send them the link, it's got all the best stuff in.
And we were talking about this a while ago, and I was thinking that, yeah, there needs to be some sort of, almost like a formal post somehow. It's almost like for the good of our alternative community that's online.
Mm.
Every community needs a Joseph.
Yeah, well, I could do with money, so I might start hiring myself out.
Uh-huh.
There was a time when a few people were giving me like a small monthly fee to be Joseph, which was quite fun. But the people that were doing it ended up having a skint period and cancelled their direct debits. But it was nice while it lasted.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, Dougal Hind from the School of Everything and Space Makers Agency and various other nice projects. The Dark Mountain Project, probably the most relevant here.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of my regular monthly sponsors for a while. He gave me a nice nickname, which was the Digital Johnny Appleseed. Because I've often got lots of files in my pocket as well.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's handy. You walk around with a big USB stick. I've also got something. It's a symbiotic engineer. What's that one?
That's like a fun title I came up with probably over 10 years ago now, as a sort of job title.
Mm-hmm.
And it was when I was framing what I do, which is kind of quite good description in some ways, as building mutually advantageous relationships between people and projects and planet and stuff. Symbiosis. It's probably grammatically should be symbiosis engineer, but symbiotic sounds better to me.
Sounds like robotic or
cybernetic
or
it's a relationship. So I mean that ties in, I guess, to lots of permaculture stuff about relative location and feedback loops and all that sort of stuff in numerous variants of permaculture principles.
Mm. And your main website is uniteddiversity.com, isn't it?
UnitedDiversity.coop now.
Ah, okay.
We've always been a co-op, but we're more and more into co-ops these days. So for the last couple of years, I've described what I do, my work, as helping people to discover, contribute to, and replicate intelligent responses to climate, energy, and economic uncertainty.
God, that sounds well remembered.
Which is quite precise, and to people that know what all those buzzwords mean, sounds wonderful, but to most people kind of doesn't really mean anything. And I've broadly come to the conclusion that the most intelligent response to climate, energy and economic uncertainty is for people to come together, start cooperatives, do community share issues, and invest in community scale infrastructure.
What's a community share issue, just so?
So a community share issue is a thing, it's kind of specific to the UK, a type of legal structure called cooperative societies and community benefit societies. They can do equity crowdfunding, for want of a better description, which is basically inviting the general public to invest in their project with much less regulation than if a normal company limited by shares does that. They've got various exemptions from FSMA, the Financial Services and Markets Act.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty much every community farm, community wind farm, community solar co-op, community shop, cooperative pub in the country.
Cooperative pub?
There's now 18 or 19 cooperative pubs around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And there's over 200 community shops, most of which are pubs or shops in rural villages, but not necessarily. There's quite a lot of urban ones as well that are closing down. So the locals gather together, start a cooperative or community benefit society, and then sell shares to the local community and the other and everyone else that wants to support such things,
mm-hmm.
to raise money to buy the shop or buy the pub or build the wind turbines.
And the reason why it's a good idea to use the co-op model is that everybody has an equal share or equal right?
Yeah, exactly. They're democratically owned and controlled, as it says in the...
On the tin.
On the tin, on the in the official definition.
Uh-huh.
So even though people can invest in these by buying what are known as withdrawable shares, and there are lots of other legal structures that you can start cooperatives with, but this is a sort of the one that's normally used in large part because of this nice, easy way to raise capital. But you can't buy power. It doesn't matter how many shares you own. It's one member, one vote.
Mm-hmm.
And things like community benefit societies, for example, in the same way as charities and community interest companies, they can have a legal asset lock so that should everything go tits up,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The assets can't be just given back to the people that invested. They stay collectively owned or given to another co-op or another charity.
Right.
So it's a good way to sort of lock in the values that the people founding them.
To make sure they don't bleed
out
into, I suppose, people who want to make lots of money.
Yeah. Although it's not mutually exclusive.
I was going to... That's one of the questions I was thinking about when I was thinking about co-ops is, do you get, like, a capitalist, I don't know, that's for want of a better word, co-ops, as in co-ops that are specifically out to... that aren't necessarily very ethical, let's say.
Well, there was a report recently, I can't remember who it was by, about co-op doesn't equal ethical. I mean, it kind of does. It's much more likely to.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, any group of people could get together and form a co-op for mutual ends, and they could be relatively unethical people. I mean, to take the sort of big example in the UK, the co-op group, for example, who run all the co-op supermarkets...
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Compared to lots of the other big supermarkets, Asda and Tesco and what have you, their orders of magnitude is more ethical. But, you know, from my perspective, their range of organic food on the shelves is abysmal.
Right.
Despite the fact that they're the 20th biggest landowner in the country.
Yeah, they're one of the biggest farmers as well, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. It's Cooperative Farms is, according to the book, Who Owns Britain, the 20th biggest landowner in the UK. I did actually ask the chairman of Co-op Group at the launch of one of the Co-op Group's ethical... Every year or so, they publish like their ethical policy or their mm-hmm. ethical plan about how they don't invest in arms and things like that. And just before... There was a lady from Oxfam talking about how supporting small-scale agroecological, very light permaculture farms is what's needed to support people mm-hmm. in the developing world and food security for them and us in the future. So off the back of her comments, I asked, well, is there a plan for the co-op group to split their immense industrial farms into small agroecological small holdings?
Fair question.
And if not, why not? And sadly, I got a very politician-like answer, which didn't answer the question at all, and said, we're not the biggest landowner, which I didn't say they were. And by the way, we've got loads of orchards in Kent. Well,
okay.
Okay, great. it's good that they're in Kent and they're growing apples there again and they're local varieties, but again, they're not doing it organically. But yeah, co-ops are definitely a lot more likely to be
mm-hmm.
more ethical. And there are various, like if you are a cooperative or community benefit society, for example, there are various legal restrictions and boundaries that you have to operate within. So if you're selling shares, you can't offer extortionate rates of return. There's like a flexible cap, which is worded something like, you can only offer as much as needed as, to attract and retain investment.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the FCA, the Financial Control Authority, I think they're called now, who've recently replaced the Financial Services Authority, they do have a slight issue with the renewable energy cooperatives, because the investors are mostly just investing for financial return,
mm-hmm.
and aren't directly buying energy off the co-ops. So they're not sort of direct users. It's like, okay, they're buying electricity. Everyone buys electricity. But there's this sort of, which I think is fairly archaic idea of what a co-op is.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of what the rules say, is that they have to be users of the co-op. So there's a kind of, within the sort of older cooperative scene, people, you know, because people have been doing this for hundreds of years, there's kind of a thing that it's not that appropriate for people that don't shop or live in or nearby a cooperative shop, for example, to invest in it and profit from it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's changing, and more people recognise that it can be communities of interest, not just geographical communities.
Thank you. Joseph, how did you get into permaculture? What's your story?
How did I get into permaculture? I think sometime in the late 90s or early noughties, I stumbled across the Permaculture Design Manual, the classic old Bill Mollison book.
Big beast.
Which I've still got a copy of somewhere. I think out in Spain, where we've got some land out there. And then I, of course, being who I am, did loads of Googling and researching and found the various old documentaries in grave danger of falling mm-hmm. food and the Global Gardener series mm-hmm. and all that sort of stuff. So then I kind of watched and read everything I could find about permaculture. Seems to be a nice sort of all-inclusive, fairly coherent and sensible approach to things.
That's a nice way of putting it.
And then quite a bit later, I thought maybe I should actually get a PDC. Mm-hmm. And I went on Patrick Whitefield's Sustainable Land Use course, which was totally awesome. I think sadly stopped doing the actual residential one, but now does an online version. And it was at Regmans Lane Farm, and it was when I did it, it was 9 weeks full-time residential Monday to Thursday.
Wow, that's quite a serious undertaking.
And the PDC was just like
a part of it.
A part of that. There was whole modules on organic horticulture and ecological interactions and sustainable forestry, and it was a totally brilliant, amazing course.
So how does that, or how does it inform your what you do these days?
Well, I don't know, I find it hard to separate things, you know, united diversity.
Yeah, some people say it's like it's embedded in them now rather than something that they...
I mean, I was already sort of into and sort of described myself as a systems thinker. So really it's kind of just a bunch of right on ecological systems thinkers writing up, you know, the science in some ways in a nice, coherent way. Mm. I mean, I remember years later when I came across the Kinsale Energy Descent Action Plan, the sort of very beginnings of the transition movement. And I bought Rob Hopkins' early thesis, I think, at the time. And I was like, wow, this is great. Someone's packaged all of the really cool things I was into, like open space technology events and permaculture, and packaged it all together into one nice little model. And called it Transition, which was excellent. There's an article going around today on the web about is transition better than permaculture or something. Whereas I personally think of transition as community scale permaculture.
Yeah, me too. And I think there's he often talks about transition being a Trojan horse for permaculture.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is an interesting way of putting it.
Which I think it has been in lots of places.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's the whole thing, you know, the way I sort of think of the history of permaculture is because of the oil crises in the 70s, Bill Mollison and David Holmgren sort of became very acutely aware of the fragility of our food system and its huge dependence on fossil fuels, which increasingly becoming, well, cheap fossil fuels, which are becoming ever more scarce and ever more expensive. And they sort of compared the, you know, a field of grain, which is a very tiny amount of biomass relative to a tropical forest, which they lived nearby. I thought, hang on a minute, yeah, there's loads of inputs of both human and fossil fuel energy, and we only get this much biomass, whereas in the forest, there's no fossil fuel or human inputs, and there's huge amounts of biomass. So what if we could mimic the relationships and structures and patterns that they find in the forest, but with plants that are more directly useful for humans, for food and textiles and fibres and what have you. I mean, it seems just like in some ways, permaculture to me is common sense, but sadly, common sense isn't very common.
Does the idea of the cooperatives dovetail very nicely? I mean, it feels that it dovetails quite nicely in the permaculture movement, and it would be an obvious thing that people would adopt.
Very much so. So sort of going back to intelligent responses to climate, energy and economic uncertainty, for me, it's all about creating, you know, community infrastructure, community scale infrastructure. So there's this guy, Vinay Gupta, who's got a nice but quite dark model called The Six Ways to Die.
Very good.
And he points out that you can only really die from six things. You can be too hot, too cold, too hungry, too thirsty, ill or injured. And he goes on to point out that what stops us dying from those things are our infrastructure. It's roads and railways and wires and power stations and but pretty much universally, at least in sort of so-called developed modern nation states,
yeah,
all of that infrastructure which keeps us alive is both heavily dependent on cheap, abundant fossil fuels and owned and controlled by large transnational corporations who don't necessarily have our interests at heart and are completely unaccountable. So at some point they will fail. For me, that's just like a
sort of
a
inevitable
given,
isn't it? Yeah.
So the faster we can create infrastructure of all kinds to cover all the six ways to die, community scale, food, energy, housing, transport, everything basically, which is owned and controlled demographically by the community and is powered renewably, the better. The faster we can do that, the better. And the people that have done that,
mm-hmm,
have almost universally used the cooperative structure to do it.
Okay. So this is where we find that part in the puzzle. Yeah, that's the way they do it.
Yeah.
In a way.
There's loads of people that want to start a permaculture farm or a permaculture something. The people that have gone through that process already have generally ended up thinking, oh, let's do a co-op, mm-hmm, a food co-op or a community supported agriculture system or whatever it is.
So what would be the benefits of that over, say, a community interest company? You know, those new sort of
Well, I mean, they're not actually mutually exclusive. So in the UK, which is, we're sort of quite lucky and it's different from most of Europe. In the UK, there isn't a singular type of legal structure for cooperatives. It's recognised as a set of principles. There are seven cooperative principles, and you can write those principles into any set, pretty much any set of legal structure rules. So you can be a cooperative CIC,
mm-hmm,
if you want to be.
Okay.
It's a bit more complex, but you could even be a sort of more cooperative charity than most charities are. You could have on your trustees, you could have some representatives of beneficiaries and things. It's all a bit complex, the charity stuff, but you can structure pretty much any organisation in a cooperative fashion. But there is definitely a revival of the community benefit and cooperative society model.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in large part because of the ease of which you can do a community share issue to raise the capital to build the house or put up the wind turbine or whatever it is.
So, how would one go about it?
United Diversity, our co-op, is about to reincorporate as a multi-stakeholder cooperative.
And what's the difference between that and a normal bog standard?
Well, historically, there have been loads of different... There's all sorts of different cooperatives, but historically, they've mostly been what are known as consumer co-ops, which the cooperative group is a,
mm-hmm,
biggest,
okay,
and best example of, which are basically lots of consumers pooling their resources to bulk buy stuff.
Okay, so it's cheaper.
Yeah.
Right.
And then there are worker co-ops, which are people organising their own labour and their own work.
Organically is a workers' co-op.
Organically are a very good example in London, yeah. Or there are housing co-ops, which are for, you know, you pay your rent to yourself, no landlords, etc. But most of them have they sort of serve one stakeholder group. It's the customers or the consumers or it's the workers or it's the people that live there. And there's a growing movement of recognising the need, you know, for organisations to make good long-term, ecologically, socially sound decisions, it makes sense for them to involve various different stakeholders.
That's what it means.
So, about 10 years ago, we were describing United Diversity as a stakeholder-governed, member-owned organisation. But at the time, there weren't actually off-the-shelf rules that would make it easy to create a multi-stakeholder organisation. You know, in 2006, Somerset Cooperative Services published the Multi-Stakeholder Cooperative Society Rules, otherwise known as the Somerset Rules, which made it much easier. Yeah, and the latest version of those, which came out in August last year, which is almost exactly 10 years after we wanted it, yeah, but it's here now finally, makes it very easy to create such organisations. And if you look internationally, so even though people often think that co-ops are small or couldn't work or don't scale, and but it's nonsense really. There's co-ops employ more people than multinationals, much more people internationally across the world.
That's mainly because India is chock-a-block full of...
Well, it's all over. I mean, there are millions of members of credit unions in the States, for example.
Mm-hmm. There's a permaculture credit union, isn't there?
Exactly, actually? There is a permaculture credit union as well. And, yeah, there are more members of co-ops than there are shareholders in private companies. Again, many orders of magnitude more. And there are some really quite large-scale, successful cooperative networks and networks of co-ops. So there's the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation in North Spain, which is actually a co-op of about 100, 200 worker co-ops and other multi-stakeholder co-ops, which together are like the fifth biggest company in Spain. And in North Italy, there's the Emilia-Romagna region, which has like the highest quality of life indices in most of Europe, and over 50%, about 50% of all their GDP comes from co-ops. And when it comes to social care and healthcare, over 80% of that is organised by what are known as social co-ops, which are basically multi-stakeholder co-ops for social and healthcare things, so that the caregivers and the care receivers and the families of the care receivers are all part of the same structure, so they can all feed into it, and the power is balanced and stuff. And recently, in the last few years, the International Labour Organization, part of the UN, I think, published a few reports about how, since the crisis of 2008, cooperatives have shown to be much more resilient to the crisis.
So we've been talking about cooperatives, and we've been bigging up cooperatives, let's face it. They sound like the best thing, easy to do. You can even just sort of copy and paste it, by the sounds of it, from a website, Somerset Rules. What about things that are difficult about cooperatives? I mean, one of the things that keeps popping up for me is I know they're becoming fashionable again and people are taking them on again, but it feels like they've had a less clout somehow. You know, they're not as, they don't wield as much power somehow in this country and abroad. We have this sort of massive capitalist model that seems to be so successful. How come cooperatives have been less able to sort of elbow their way into the marketplace? Is that because of the fact that it's one person, one vote, that actually things are a bit more slower to happen?
I'm not sure, actually. I think it's a very complex, you know, history of... in, for example, Spain and Italy and Japan, various other parts of the world, they are a much more significant and powerful voice, which is a bit peculiar because, like, the cooperative principles, as they're known now, were kind of first formalised in Rochdale, just outside Manchester, in 1844 or something. And that first shop, which was, you know, it was started by 28 people in poor houses, sort of things, probably weavers, who put 2p a week into a pot in order to buy a bit of bread and flour collectively to sell back to themselves affordably. And in today's money, that's about £10 a month or something. And even though that was their very sort of humble beginnings of a little bit of bread and flour, in their incorporation docs, there's like, as soon as possible to organise the production and exchange of the government and the society and all this sort of stuff. So they had they had big goals. There's a really good book that I'm reading at the moment, actually, called Humanising the Economy, Cooperatives in the Age of Capital, which has got quite a lot of fascinating history, socio-political history of co-ops and kind of how... And the way he tells the story in there is partly that the sort of Marxist message became more... So in the early days, Engels and Marx visited some of the first cooperative villages that Robert Owen and other people founded in North England. There are all sorts of utopian models of whole cooperative towns and things like that, some of which did work for multiple decades. And there were sort of huge... house building movements and things like that, like the building societies are cooperative structures, and they're originally for people building their own houses in a cooperative manner and stuff like that. Lots of them have since demutualized. And I can't remember the specifics, really. Buy the book, it's a really good book. In the book they describe how Marx and Engels visited the utopian villages that Robert Owen and others created, which were like a mecca for thinking people at the time. And somewhere along the line, I can't remember the specifics, it's near the beginning of the book and I'm towards the end of it now. Somehow the message of Marxism became more easily received by the working masses, and that sort of happened and they went down a sort of different path. So originally they were, Marx and Engels and stuff were really into cooperatives. But then they saw them as sort of being utopian and trying to do too much too quick, and we have to take the power from the state and all this sort of stuff. It's a really interesting and actually quite relevant for now story, actually. But
well, yeah, specifically because, they are different. There are overlaps, but they're very different camps, aren't they? And the cooperatives have definitely a solid place in our... in under fabric, you know. I mean, as you're saying, there's a big farmers, you know, cooperative bank. They're here. They're on the high street.
And I think there have been, there's also been lots of anti-propaganda from capitalist media and stuff like that over the years. Which has probably also helped keep a lid on it, sort of thing.
I'm just wondering whether the fact that there's so many sort of people owning it, you know, like classically, consensus decision-making process is a bit slower than one person at the top making decisions, and therefore less likely to be able to manoeuvre very quickly. I know that I was reading one article about the CEO of the Co-op Bank saying, yeah, that was something that it had laboured under before.
Mm.
But because they've now got CEO structure and stuff like that, it's actually a lot easier for them to be able to play a stronger role.
Yeah, I mean, that could be part of it. I mean, for me, there's an interesting thing about scale here as well. So the ones that have seemed to be more popular, and in this country, other than Radical Roots, who are an amazing example of a network of co-ops, they're a network of co-ops for social change, housing co-ops and social centres and workers' co-ops and things, but they're still quite small because they're sort of specifically for radical activists.
Mm-hmm.
But other than them, they're sort of an exception to the rule in this country. We tend to think of co-ops as an individual co-op, a co-op here, a co-op there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas on the continent, especially in Spain and Italy, they think more about networks of co-ops or even networks of just small, medium-sized enterprises. So in the Emilia-Romagna region in northern Italy, for example, there's people like Ferrari are based there and all sorts of top, amazing companies that have for a long time actually been really quite small, and they've got supply chains which are made up of networks of co-ops and small, medium-sized enterprises. So someone might be, for making a shirt, for example, there might be a small co-op or family business that makes the twine, and another one that sews, that cuts the patterns. Mm-hmm. And
so
the whole fabric
is that way.
So another one that does the buttons, but they're competing as individual companies, but they cooperate because they all do a little part of the, which in some ways is lots of parallels to permaculture there. All the sort of niches and multiple
functions, multiple elements,
and all that sort of stuff, and diversity and edges and there, funnily enough, there has been quite a lot of sort of research into what's called the Emilian model of, because it is sort of capitalism in a sense, because not all of them are co-ops, they're sort of co-ops of small, medium-sized enterprises. The whole idea of clustering small businesses and things like that was kind of learned and picked up from the cooperative movement in North Italy.
One of the things that attracts me particularly about the cooperative model is this idea of democracy in an organisation. And one of my current heroes at the moment is Ricardo Semler, who I think it was you that put me onto his book originally, and talking specifically about workplace democracy. And now that's not a co-op, is it? His business in, is it Argentina?
Yeah.
And but...
I think it's Brazil, right? Semco.
That's it. But he has been able to bring some of the ideas that I imagine came originally from the cooperative models into a different type of firm.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, perhaps, a lot of sort of new modern social innovation, social enterprises, some of them are kind of more cooperatives than some cooperatives are. They might not be legally structured that way, but their culture might be more cooperative, and they actually involve people more in the decision making and things like that. Because especially in the bigger, large scale co-ops, the people that work in co-op supermarkets don't have really that much more say, and the people that shop at them, who are the members who technically ultimately own it, we don't really have that much say. Occasionally, I can vote for a regional representative. It's a bit like our parliamentary system. It's like, okay, can you really call it democratic? Only in a very sort of weak, light way, really. It's not participatory direct democracy, it's a sort of many layers down of representative democracy. So I think that co-ops are best staying small and then networking together for scale, which, of course, with the internet is ever, ever more easy.
So I was just seeing that uniteddiversity.com, which it's been going a little while now, seems to have a new input, a new lease of life, becoming a multi-stakeholder cooperative. And how did that come about?
Yeah, it's all quite exciting, actually. So United Diversity, yeah, we started in about 2000 organising live music events because music brings people together, and we used to give out CD-ROMs of our Tools for Change library, which is the early version of what's now online.
Nice.
And like I mentioned earlier, we've been wanting to be a sort of member-owned, stakeholder-governed network for about 10 years, but now these nice multi-stakeholder cooperative society rules exist. But for a while, I was like, okay, well, who else other than me and my colleague Tom, who are all these other stakeholders, and what are we actually going to do? And then quite, probably about a year ago now, I got a call from a couple of guys, Marcus and Joe, who they met as charity muggers, chuggers, yeah, the people that sign you up for direct debits on the street. I think they were raising funds for UNICEF or Save the Children or something. And they thought there must be a more exciting way of raising money for good causes, more adventurous and where it gets them off the streets of London. So they decided to do a bike tour from Camden Town to Cape Town.
My God.
And they decided to go via the Middle East instead of just straight down, because that would be more interesting. But because neither of them had actually done a long-distance bike ride before, they thought, well, maybe we should do Land's End to John O'Groats first. This was 2 years ago now, I think. To see how they like it. So they did that. It went really well.
Is that the one that you recently did?
No, that was 2 years before.
Mm-hmm.
But that went really well. So the following autumn or winter, they left to head off to Cape Town. And they got as far as Turkey, which is quite far.
It's pretty damn far.
And while they were in Istanbul, they went into an internet cafe and came across my idea for a Building Man festival. Building Man is obviously a sort of a play on Burning Man Festival. And I've never been to Burning Man, but lots of friends have, and I've read a lot about it and watched videos about it. And in many ways, it's completely amazing. Yeah, they've got these great principles about leaving no trace, although that's impossible since everyone flies there. But they don't leave any rubbish, and it's fully participatory, and there's no audience, and it's all a gift economy, and there's lots of really amazing things about it. And for me, one of the most amazing things is that they essentially build a city in the desert for 10 days, 2 weeks, or whatever it is. But given the sort of predicaments we face as a species, I thought, what if we could sort of harness that same self-organising creative energy and power, but rather than building temporary cities in deserts, building eco-villages in sensible places and leaving them there? And that was the idea of Building Man Festival. And every time I've shared that, people go, oh, that's a really good idea. And it's kind of like a perma-blitz.
Yeah.
But more focused on natural building than on doing a suburban yard. But I never really did that much with... I had a couple of tiny mini Building Man festivals on the land that we've got out in Spain. But never really did much with it. And they came across the idea, really loved it, loved the name. We're having similar ideas anyway, because they organise Cloud Cuckoo Land Festival, which happens
that,
in
yeah.
Somerset on Fernhill Farm, where the Big Green Gathering spent most of its life. And they had sort of been working towards creating permanent festival sites. That's the angle they had been coming from it. So when they got back from their Manif trip, they ended up turning back from Turkey because they didn't want to fly, and all the ferries had cancelled because the Syria stuff had already started it was all getting quite heavy. So instead of carrying on through the Middle East, they turned back and went through the Mediterranean, went to Greece and visited lots of cool projects in Europe, and then made their way back to the UK. And when they got back, they phoned up and said, well, we had this chat about Building Man, and they're also in the process of wanting to turn Cloud Cuckoo Land into a co-op, some kind of cooperative structure, so it was community owned, so that, because it's always been, and similar to Burning Man in some ways, very participative, and all the core people work for free and stuff like that. So I sort of sold the idea of starting multi-stakeholder co-ops, and they really liked the idea. So there was a plan that Cloud Cuckoo Land, which is the community arts festival, Break the Cycle, which are these great fundraising cycling tours where we visit permaculture projects and things like that, which I did just go on this year, which was awesome. Next year, actually, it's going to be a cycling PDC. We're actually going to do a not Land's End to John O'Groats, probably a shorter cycle, but with more time in places. And it's going to be a permaculture design course structured around a cycle tour. It's going to be amazing. Right. Yeah, come on it. Check out breakthecycle.org.uk, I think it is. Well, then it's probably not details there. And then there's various other projects involved, like Upcycle, which is an upcycling festival waste management project that do free shops and upcycle shops and stuff at festivals. And there was a plan to turn all these different projects into their own multi-stakeholder co-op. And just before Building Man was due to happen, which was in this May, after we'd all cycled three weeks together doing Land's End to John O'Groats in the coldest spring in 50 years, which was quite an experience, but totally amazing. We visited loads of incredible permaculture projects like Land Matters, which are a permaculture cooperative, and yeah, loads of amazing projects all over the country. And I propose, hang on a minute, rather than starting loads of different co-ops, why don't we start with starting one? And we can call it United Diversity, because I'm in the process of starting an multi-stakeholder co-op anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And we can have all these projects that we all do together as projects of United Diversity. And maybe at some point, should they reach a particular scale, we'll spin them off as their own co-ops.
Mm.
And we'll help people start other co-ops and stuff like that. So we're just on the brink of incorporating the new multi-stakeholder co-op together, which brings all these projects together.
Great.
Is
that the thing that you're embroiled in at the moment?
Yeah, we spent a few days, the week before last, I think it was, we gathered to come up with what's our shared mission. We've decided it's to create and share tools for self-organisation to empower people, build community and develop cooperatives. And we also agreed that we all really like the permaculture ethics and principles, so we're going to sort of, that's going to be a framework for our work. So we're a multi-stakeholder cooperative network whose goal is to help start permaculture co-ops, in effect.
Wow.
Network them all together. So yeah, get involved with us if you want to get involved. I mean, to start with, we're going to focus, definitely get involved, because I love helping and sharing my knowledge. That's what I'm all about, really.
Yeah, how do people find out about you?
Easiest way is to just Google for United Diversity, but yeah, it's uniteddiversity.coop, or you can email me.
Are you a Twitter type person?
I'm on
person.
Twitter as well. United Diversity's got an account, but I'm more active. J. Davis Coates, JDAVIESCOTES. I'm probably a little bit too active on Facebook. You can find me on there as well. But yeah, if you search for Joseph Davis Coates and or United Diversity, I'm very easy to find.
Wicked. Well, thanks for having you over here. Thanks for chatting.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And I hope you manage to seed some more information to people who've been listening. That'd be great. And thanks, Delroy and Simone. And we'll leave you with Mission Impossible.